I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, growing up, the skyline, and the city.
You know, when you think of a skyline, or if you think of a city generally, you perceive it in the facade of a city, and that's what we think of as a skyscraper, the face of the city. Atlanta has, like New York, a very linear skyline. When we think of New York as the sort of ultimate skyline of skyscrapers, it is because Manhattan is a very long, narrow island, and we look at its long side, and you see spread out left to right this extraordinary facade of a city that's the skyline. Atlanta comparably has that because we're built on a ridge, and the ridge is essentially Peachtree Street, and it works its way from Five Points, winds its way with all kinds of turns and the like, but it nevertheless is still a spine that goes all the way up to Buckhead and beyond. And that's totally generated by topography.
When the 2000 census came out, I was still a reporter at the Journal Constitution, and we wanted to do some stories sort of taking a look at, just how the city had changed and all. And I did this big Sunday takeout about what a sprawling place Atlanta had become. And one of the things I did for it I wanted to get a picture of that. I wanted to really see it in my own, with my own eyes. So I called up Captain Herb, the traffic reporter for WSB Radio, and I went up in his helicopter with him one morning. And, of course, we were, motoring up over Georgia 400, looking at all the traffic going every which way. And that was the first time I knew intellectually that Atlanta had all of these cluster cities all over the place. But that was the first time that I actually literally had seen that we have at least three distinctive skylines. And it was so striking to me that I actually arranged to have a photographer go back up with him, and that ended up being the lead photo for the thing, these three skylines seen sort of stair-stepped across the horizon. That was what Atlanta had become.
My guests today are architectural historian and professor emeritus at Georgia Tech, Robert Craig.
If you go in the lobby of the Marriott Marquis and you look up at that extraordinary space, I would ask, are you in a piece of architecture or are you in some gargantuan piece of sculpture?
30-year veteran of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and author of Southern Culture, Jim Ockmoody.
If you were growing up here during that time, you took a lot of pride in that skyline. You would track those buildings the way you would follow Hank Aaron hitting home runs for the Braves. It was an accomplishment.
Chip Simone, an acclaimed Atlanta street photographer.
I still don't know on any given day what I'm out to photograph, but I know that there are things out there that are wonderful to see. There always are. Life is beautiful. Life is very fascinating. And for people like me, it provides opportunities to see the most remarkable things.
And Jim Osier, a falcon expert and program manager with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources.
They have adapted well, and they do live on cliffs in the wild. And Georgia doesn't have too many cliffs. We've got a few rocky areas in the northern part of the state. So that was where the nesting range extended. But as we've built cities and as we've brought the population of falcons back, they have come to accept these high-rise buildings as a substitute for a cliff.
Someday my baby with my and others have taught me the best that they can. They sell me a suit, they cut off my hair, they send me to work in tall buildings. So it's goodbye to the sunshine, goodbye to the dew, goodbye to the flowers, and goodbye to you. I'm off to the subway, I must not be late. I'm going to work in tall buildings.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Growing Up, the Skyline and the City. Now, it should be admitted at the start that it is slightly confusing, if not misleading, to talk about the skyline in the singular as one unified entity. I mean, a skyline should possess a unity and harmony to it, but a skyline is not static, nor is it really one thing. It's a dynamic representation of the evolution of the city and is made of many elements, primarily buildings, and especially really tall buildings. So, to begin our story today of the Atlanta skyline, we must begin at the first story, the first skyscraper.
If you define it in terms of what a number of historians define it to be, which has to do with its height and its use of steel frame and its use of an elevator, those three elements, then it would manifest itself in those terms in Chicago with a home insurance building in the late 1880s. So it emerges at that point, and we begin to see it in Atlanta in the 1890s with some of what's down in Fairly Poplar now. A couple of them are in a kind of an aesthetic that we think of as a commercial Chicago style.
But it was a technological advancement, not like this, an aspirational one, really.
Well, it was both, because you can define the skyscraper technically, which is essentially what I first did, which had to do with the capacity to go higher because of steel frame, even though it may not, to today's scale, seem to be that high as you look at those early skyscrapers, 10 and 15 stories. Brick pretty well maxed out at 16 to 17 stories. The Monadnock building in Chicago and the tower of the auditorium building were both at the point at which if you add another brick, it would fall over just about. And shift then to technology raised a whole new scale in the perception of architects and certainly citizens who up to that point considered a commercial building as being a two- or three-story building. So many towns had pretty well that. And when these began to shoot up to 10, 15 stories, and then very quickly the potential of greater height than that, it posed a design problem. What do you do with this sheer bulk? What do you do to design it? And so the question of what's the first skyscraper has two answers. One of them is what is the first skyscraper technically, and then what would you consider the first skyscraper from a design point of view?
What would you?
Well, again, it comes down at that point to Louis Sullivan out of Chicago, although it's in two buildings that he designed, not in Chicago. They're in St. Louis and in Buffalo. The St. Louis one is known as the Wainwright Building, and it essentially responds for the first time to an architect trying to ask that question, what should be the telling issue about the tall building from a design point of view? In other words, how do you design a tall building? And Sullivan's answer was pretty simple. It was you express its tallness, and you try to find ways that you can express that aspiration and verticality. He did it with a number of techniques of narrowing the window bay and adding some additional vertical elements to the facade, so it kind of pinched the building, and like a garden hose that you squeeze the end of, the water comes flying out faster when you reduce that volume, and so that visually works the same way. You make a narrow bay and your eye fires up, and that kind of expressiveness is part of what he was trying to bring to the building.
Pretty so high,
so high, we can't get on.
So wide,
so wide.
So low,
so low, you can't
get God Almighty,
you must come in at the door.
It is high,
so high, you can't get on.
It is wide,
so wide, you can't get around.
So low,
so low.
And while the skyline represents the city, it can also represent something much more deeply personal for the people living in its shadow.
I came of age during the 60s, really. And that was a period when Atlanta became, in the lexicon of the time, a major league city. Because, you know, the Braves came from Milwaukee in 66. The Falcons started that fall. I think the Hawks started the following year, came from St. Louis. And so, you know, Metro Atlanta had just turned 1 million population. And there was an overwhelming sense here that we wanted to become a major league city and put ourselves on the map. And the booming skyline of the 60s and 70s was very much part of that. My father was an auditor at General Motors, and so he kept lists of things. He was a great Southern storyteller, but he was also an auditor, so he had this sort of keeping track of things side to him. And I've inherited both those traits. And whenever new buildings were announced or topped out on the skyline, me and my father would make lists of them. I mean, I actually had a list at one point of all the buildings in Atlanta that were over 20 stories. I used to take the bus from Decatur with some of my friends downtown, and we would just go up. We'd ride the elevator up in whatever the last high building was that was built. And I can remember going and, you know, knocking on office doors on the 30th floor of this building or that, and asking some lawyer if I could go take a look out of his window just to sort of see what my hometown looked like from this newest building.
You wrote about a week-long feature for the paper about the history of Peachtree, right?
Yeah, I did. And we were looking for something to do to mark the end of the 20th century, and something local that would sort of tell the story of how Atlanta came to be what it is. And we hit on this idea of telling a good slice of the city's history through Peachtree, through that name, through that legend, through that reality of that street and the things that had happened along it.
And what part did the, you know, high-rises, skyscrapers, and skyline play in that?
Well, there was one part of that story, that series, that dealt specifically with sort of the business history that had unfolded along the street. And the person who motivated that story, who was in it more than anybody else, was John Portman, who grew up right off of Peachtree, who went to Georgia Tech. And, of course, who completely changed the skyline along Peachtree with the Peachtree Center and the Regency and the Peachtree Plaza and all those buildings he built there. And I remember one of the things that was interesting, we did a graphic that ran with that story that showed a succession. It was like a historical, it was tracing the tallest building in town was basically what it was. And what you find is that through most of the 1800s, the tallest structure in Atlanta was a church steeple. I think the First Methodist Church, which was where the Candler Building later went up, was for a long time the tallest thing in Atlanta. Then you have, skyscrapers, modern buildings coming up. And there was a whole succession of them. The Equitable Building, which was where the Trust Company of Georgia was headquartered, and is not the Equitable Building that's standing there now. It was the tallest building for a few years in the 1890s. Then you had the Flatiron Building, still down there across from Woodruff Park. I've got a list here of the 11 buildings that have been the tallest building in Atlanta in the last 100 and something years. And what I was going to say was that the only reason I mentioned that right now is because the good news is that only one of them actually has been torn down. The Equitable Building was torn down in 1971 there at Woodruff Park to make way for what was then the Trust Company of Georgia building.
What are the others?
Well, the Equitable Building was the tallest in the 1890s. That was followed by the Flatiron Building, which is still there. And then that was followed briefly right after the turn of the century, 1901, by the Empire Building, which is where the Georgia State University Business School is now. There's a beautiful bank lobby in the bottom of it that was designed by Philip Schutze, you know, the great neoclassicist architect here. It didn't last long, though, as the tallest building. The tallest building for a long time after that was the Candler Building, right there in the same neighborhood. The Candler Building was 17 stories tall. It was built by Asa Candler, the founder of the Coca-Cola Company. And it's still one of my favorite buildings because of all the ornamentation on it and those little friezes with, you know, figures of faces of Shakespeare and Joel Chandler Harris and Candler's parents. And it's just kind of an eccentric building. After that, it was the Rhodes Haverty Building, which is like only a block up the street on Peachtree, which is a great Art Deco building, which I think is now a hotel. And then Atlanta doesn't start building tall buildings again really until a few years after the war, World War II. And the Fulton National Bank Building, which is a fairly nondescript kind of modern-looking building on Marietta Street right near the Henry Grady statue, it was built in the mid-50s. And it was the next tallest one. It was the one that superseded the Candler or the Rhodes Haverty Building, finally. Right after that, you had a building right at Five Points that was known as the BG Building when I was growing up, the Bank of Georgia Building. It's now One Park Tower, I think, is its official name. And then it was followed by another bank building across the street at Five Points, the First National Bank of Atlanta Tower, which was, I think, the first building in Atlanta over 40 floors. And then it was the tallest building in the late 60s and early 70s, and then it was superseded by the Peachtree Plaza, which when I was in school, we called it the Phallus Palace, for obvious reasons. The whole thing of building a very tall building that looks like a glass silo is really kind of a cliche now. I mean, we see that in so many cities. Portman's built a lot of them, actually. But it was a lot fresher idea then. The building that became the tallest in town for a while after the Peachtree Plaza is one of my favorites. It became the tallest in 1987, and it's the building that kind of broke the mold in many ways for tall buildings in Atlanta, and it's what everybody here calls the IBM Tower, but it's One Atlantic Center. That building opened in 1987. It is a beautiful neo-Gothic building designed by Philip Johnson and John Berge. And it was the first building built in Atlanta probably since the 30s that wasn't a flat top. It had a spire. Now, every building built in Atlanta, it seems like, after that, for the next 10 or 15 years, had some sort of spire on it, probably the most conspicuous of which is the Bank of America Plaza, which came along just about 5 years after the IBM Tower and has been for the last 20 years the tallest building in Atlanta. Actually, the Bank of America Tower, it's the tallest building in America outside of Chicago or New York.
It's one of those curious things about skyscrapers, that they should be characterized by their extreme height. But what actually distinguishes them, what defines them in our imagination, is just the very tip-top.
Whether that top is just rising above its neighbors or whether it's sitting isolated, it still tends to be that we look up and see how this building looks on the crown. Yeah. You can see that. If I said Nations Bank in Atlanta, everybody would think of it at night with that open frame of steel and the inner glowing light from within. It's sometimes been whimsically referred to as a hot poker of a skyscraper, but it has this kind of quality that people find pleasant to the eye, and it becomes their favorite building because of that particular thing. But what they're looking at is the top of the building. As it happens, the building is not very well detailed, and on the lower level, it looks like a kind of cardboard model of a building that's been translated a little too literally into the built work. But the skyline and the skyscraper cap does have a quality that people remember, and it springs in the more historical, formal way to these temple tops on 20s buildings.
There is always an inherent difficulty on this show in speaking about the physical world and describing things with words that are generally better understood with images. But in listening to you describe architecture, it's so apparent that there's this vocabulary for architecture, and more specifically for skyscrapers, that really matches the scale and grandiosity of the buildings.
You know, architecture is a language, and it has words, and it has descriptive words, and it has action words, and a building has function, and it has ornament, and it has the bare bones person, place, and thing words, et cetera, so that you could begin to get people thinking about architecture as a language, and then it becomes clear that language can be dull prose or journalism, or it can be poetic, and it can convey itself through a rote and fairly monotone presentation verbally, or it can be full of oratory. Architecture can have rhetoric. It has a grammar. It has all these things by analogy to language, and that you can perceive of as a way to understand how the design works and how the language conveys certain ideas through a three-dimensional physical thing. And there's this wonderful visual literacy that once you start looking, you discover things you never noticed before. And that's what it's all about. And that's the joy of it.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Growing Up, the Skyline and the City, brought to you by Perkins & Will. For most of us, the skyline of a city is visualized as a snapshot, that postcard image, an easy shorthand for what the city is. So, Who better to help us understand and explore the significance of Atlanta skyline than one of its best-known photographers of city life?
I came to Atlanta with my wife in 1972 to join a few friends that I had known over the years who had settled here and were establishing a photographic community here. Because the South is burdened with its own unique kind of history, when I came here and I inquired about the area, I was directed away from the city. I was told to go to Washington and Madison and look for the sort of antebellum ruins of the decayed South, the old South, the South that was defeated in war. And I made some of those trips, but I really didn't relate to those things. I'm really I'm a street photographer, but which that means, in part, I like to work in the urban setting. I like to work in a very immediate environment. I don't like to look backward in terms of historical time. So I started to walk the streets of Atlanta, and this was in 72, and of course, the city has changed quite a bit in that time. And I realized that there was a large, complicated city happening here, but no one was looking at it visually. So I made another group of friends, musicians, entertainers, people who perhaps were denizens of the netherworld, the underbelly of the city, you might say, some more curious characters, and I began photographing.
The fun part.
Yeah. I mean, really the much more interesting part, because you were up against a very self-conscious city that had very clear notions of how they wanted the city thought about, the sort of Chamber of Commerce way of looking at it, which is pretty boring, actually. And I insisted on finding my own way of looking at the city and describing it. So I took to the streets. Sure. I have walked all of Peachtree Street from where it begins at I-20 now, because they extended it from Five Points, where it used to be Whitehall, out to the Chamblee line. I mean, I haven't done it, but it's 10.1 miles is the length of Peachtree Street. It's
and
not
you've
all
done
that
it
long.
With camera in hand?
Yes, yes, and it's a very uneven trip. I mean, there are parts that are very active, and then there are the parts where there's nothing going on. I equated it one time to like a smile with a number of teeth missing in it. As you walk along Peachtree Street, there are the big expanses where nothing is really happening yet. And I would walk the streets looking for things to make pictures about. No matter where I'm looking, I try to find the unexpected epiphany, the little sort of detail or gem you can find even in an empty space that is filled somehow either with a human presence or with one of those little blessings in life where things fall in place and create an unexpected form of beauty.
If you're taking a picture of the skyline, it's been photographed, I don't know how many times, a lot. Like, mm-hmm. how do you change it to make it interesting the time that you're photographing?
Well, the skyline has changed. And by that I mean not only are different buildings added to the length of Peachtree Street, but where it becomes photographed best from. There's a bridge behind Georgia Baptist Hospital that used to be the place. We referred to it as Kodak Bridge. I mean, inside the photo community. And I used to tease people that there were three holes in the sidewalk that were worn from somebody's tripods over time. And, you know, somebody say, where can I get the best picture? I say, go to this bridge, look for the three holes, set your camera up right there. You can't miss. And it was really the background shot for all the news programs, weather things. But now a lot of the views are being taken from the west side of town. Over by Bacchanalia and that area, looking back toward the city, there's a very different. So you're looking down 10th or 14th Street.
What's changed?
Well, I happen to be very fond of the mosque that's gone up on 14th Street. And when you're coming from, say, Northside, back into the city, and you get this Moorish kind of conventional mosque architecture, and you see the skyline of Peachtree behind it, it gives more of an international kind of flavor to it, which I think is very intriguing.
We're going to conclude today with one last foreign and intriguing new addition to the Atlanta skyline, a final feather in the city's cap, you might say. To tell us about it is Jim Osier.
Well, I don't make many trips to downtown Atlanta for sure, but it turns out that these peregrine falcons are one species that has adapted very well to living in an urban environment. And their natural habitat would be the high rocky cliffs, of which we only have a few in very north part of Georgia. So really, northern Georgia is the southern extent of this species' normal nesting range. Well, it belongs to a group we call raptors, or predatory birds. You know, they have the hooked beak and the strong feet for capturing prey. The specializations that a peregrine has in particular is that of speed, and it catches other birds by climbing high above them, usually, and stooping down at a very high rate of speed, sometimes probably in excess of 200 miles an hour they're capable of.
You know. They're the fastest bird?
Probably either the fastest or certainly one of the fastest. And, you know, that's faster than you can fall just from gravity. They actually accelerate downward beyond what gravity would propel them downward.
So now the birds have started to make a pretty dramatic comeback, right?
They have. I will mention that historically there was only one documented nest in Georgia, and that was back in the early 40s, and that was up at Cloudland Canyon, which is now a state park in the northwestern part of the state. And so from that time on, probably all through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s even, there were no nesting falcons in Georgia as far as we knew. And then when they started back, you know, the nest we found in Atlanta back in the 90s would have been the first one.
And tell us about that.
Well, I think some people in the city had seen birds hanging around the Marriott Marquis. And I know one guy in particular had an interest, and I didn't find out about this till later, but he saw them hanging around a certain site, and he actually put a nest box in that location. What the birds are looking for is certainly a high cliff-like location, but they also need, if possible, some kind of a little bit of a soft substrate, of course, to put the eggs on. Just putting on bare rock or concrete, as you can imagine, might not be the best thing to do. So he put a little box full of little sand and pebbles in a vent up where he'd been seeing them hanging around, and apparently they did try to nest that year. And I didn't find out about that till later, but he said, another wild falcon showed up and disrupted the nesting, and they were not successful. And then the next year, that same pair moved over onto the SunTrust Tower. One of their offspring, apparently, started a nest, you know, about a mile and a half north of that site up at the Four Seasons Hotel, and they've been doing well there ever since. They're not very accessible either. They're up on about 20 floors in a ventilation duct on the side of the building. Now, the ones at SunTrust are on a balcony about 50 floors up, 51 or two, and I'm able to get access to band the birds in that nest, which if we put little, you know, bands on their legs with numbers on them so we can identify them if they're found later on.
Speaking of visibility, the most well-known falcons in Atlanta are clearly the ones over at the Georgia Dome. And although that team may have migrated long before these most recent nests were formed, do you think that there's still some serendipitous connection between the team name and the bird?
I think they just, you know, looked around and this was one to choose from, even though it might not have been something that would be seen very much in Atlanta at that time. You know, little did they know that a few years down the road, most people could go out in Atlanta, you know, on most days, especially during the spring and summer, and have a reasonable chance of seeing a falcon flying around. As most teams do, if they're looking for a mascot, they want something that, you know, embodies the characteristics they're looking for, speed and power, and to be fearsome to their opponents. And I guess that's one reason they're used as mascots, too, because it's something that we sort of see a little bit of it in ourselves most. You know, we'd all like to be able to fly quickly, maybe, and subdue anything smaller than ourselves. So. Maybe that's just me talking.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Robert Craig, Jim Ockmoody, Chip Simone, and Jim Osier. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, architecture firm Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. We'll see you next month.